Welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. Eric Steven is with me. Dodgers is whatever. They did something about a week ago. It wasn't
all I know
win.
Is we said we were going to wait to record a series preview for the Dodgers if they won. But all I know is the National League team, the World Series has its National League team. So what are we recording today?
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't get it. We're gonna talk about that. Not so enjoyable game five. It was a good game, but not in the Dodgers' favor. Do a little bit of cleanup on sort of off-season news that's trickled out in the week since, and I think just kind of hold each other, Eric. I think that's all I need. I need a hug.
Virtually, yeah. We're recording in different states at the moment, but we are virtually hugging each other. I'm holding my microphone cord my earphone cord rather tightly. So in a sense, that you can pretty much feel it through that, right?
I can feel it.
Yeah.
We'll do that all after this. So I guess we should start with game five.
Which series was this?
This was the NLDS against the Washington Nationals. Your National League champion, pennant winning.
Nationals League champion. It was so long ago because the Nationals have won two series since the time we last recorded.
Night and day. Like, I'm sure this isn't too consoling for everybody. It has to feel good to have a team take a team to the brink where you are one home run a little longer, one Clayton Kershaw slider a little less hung from maybe yourself being the team that demolishes the Cardinals.
Yeah, and then look at the flip side, right? Because there's two ways of this. Like, you know, if you're a Dodger fan, you're just like, oh, great. Like, yeah, it could have been us. Why aren't we in the World Series? Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. But look at the Braves. Like, the Braves got punked at home. They lost game four in a walk-off fashion. They had a similar, we'll talk about it, but not, like, it wasn't at home, but it was, like, a possible go-ahead home run in this like weird postseason of not as many home runs. And then they lost game four, and then in game five at home, they had a home game just like the Dodgers did, but they gave up 10 runs in the first. Like that, they had their hearts ripped out from them against the Cardinals. And to top it all off, then the Cardinals like absolutely get decimated by the Nationals. The Nationals outscored the Cardinals 20-6 in the NLCS, and four of the runs came tonight in Game Four. So, they have to watch their division rival Nationals do what they couldn't do. Like it has to be just absolutely that's if we're talking which division winner got the most crushed by losing the division series, it's the Braves. So the Dodgers at least have that, I guess? I don't know.
That said, if we want to talk about getting crushed, that Game 5 went a long way in that feeling. There's a lot of talk. I know this happened amongst some True Blue LA writers, and I'm sure it happened in various social groups and maybe amongst your all's friends. But like, does this feel worse than the last 2 years losing the World Series? And I don't want to necessarily evaluate it quantitatively, but to me it hurts. It is a different kind of pain, I think this hurts worse than last year for sure. I don't know about games 2 and 5 of 2017. Those were a special kind of hell that I went through. But like I went into the series texting, I don't think it was you. I think it was another friend of mine. And I went into this saying, I'm like, I just don't want Clayton Kershaw and Kenley to be the bad guys. And sort of got half my wish. But at the same time, it's like, Kenley didn't do anything bad, but that's because he was so bad during the regular season that he wasn't trusted. So
right. Imagine like the worst way possible to lose a game, like a series deciding game at home from a narrative standpoint.
Yeah.
Like the Dodgers kind of rolled out all the possibilities. And
especially like from you and I, like going into this, I really like Dave Roberts. He was one of my favorite players when he was on the Dodgers. He seems to be very affable, a very players first coach. I like him. I want him to do well. Clayton Kershaw, I love. He's my favorite baseball player of all time. I want him to do well. And this just crapped on it in the most dramatic, heartbreaking fashion. Before we keep going, I do want to mention, this is going to be a very stream of consciousness episode.
Yep.
Your outline to me is almost always like 6 bullet points.
Yeah.
Yours is 4 bullet points, but 3 of the bullet points have, it's something like 25 sub-bullet points. So we're gonna really just be kind of going from the hip here. So bear with us as we... this is group therapy, I think.
Yeah, and so like just a peek behind the curtain here too. Usually when I send you the notes, I do condense it because I write these like if I'm especially looking up stats or something, or like I just want to make sure I hit certain things or certain points, and so I make the sub points, but I don't email them all to you unless they're like something that we're relevant with, that we're both talking about or something. So I happen to just do a quick cut and paste tonight to send it over to you. And so you got the whole shebang. Whew. So,
and even then, I don't know, this is from the heart. So Walker Buehler, pretty damn good.
Yes. Okay. So yeah. Okay.
Let's just go through it. Let's just go. We'll rip the Band-Aid.
So that aforementioned Braves Cardinals game was the day game on Wednesday. both games by, and then they had like all the pregame stuff, like we're waiting to talk to like managers. I forgot who spoke before game 5 for the Dodgers because they didn't do the next game starter because it was, you know, a new series, so I don't remember who spoke actually, but everyone's like looking at their phone like, wait, what's the score in that game? Oh, it's already like 4-0 and Foltynewicz is out, and it's 7, oh, it's 10, oh no, like it just got really dark early. So off the heels, that game was over so early, so everyone's like just waiting for Dodgers Nationals. The National League were the only 2 games that day. And then the Dodgers come out, and look, Strasburg has been wonderful, like just absolutely great. He carved the Dodgers up in game 2. He had 3 scoreless innings in the wild card game. He comes into that game, and the we talked about this, they have to like get his pitch count up, you know, and they did like early. And then Muncy also hit a 2-run home run against him. And I think I texted you this. I know I texted my brothers this. I can't remember the press box ever shaking like that. Like when Max Muncy hit a 2-run home run in the first, the Dodger Stadium was very loud and like very active. And it's, you know, it's an old stadium, but it's like pretty structurally sound, and it's not like
I was,
you know,
watching
these, like,
from my home in Kansas City. Yeah. So I can't attest to how loud it was then. The loudest I have ever seen Dodger Stadium was the Uribe home run.
That was pretty loud too. Or like, but in terms of like, I literally, like, you know, you say like you something gives you goosebumps.
Yeah.
Like I could feel this moment like more than anything. I will say this, for the Uribe home run, I was sitting in the back in the dining room. So maybe I wasn't at that, but I know that was super loud. I will say that could have definitely been one. The Turner home run was pretty loud.
This was, narratively, yeah, we talk about that, just like, yeah, which definitely fuels how I think your average fan feels going into this game. This was, mm-hmm, as close as I've felt. Like, I did not know if the Dodgers were favorites. And I tend to be a fairly optimistic fan. I didn't know. And a lot of that hinged on, well, they have Strasburg going, and he's so good generally, so good in the playoffs, and so good against the Dodgers. So if you can score a run with him while Walker Buehler looks like he's on, which he did for most, yep, of the night, you feel like, how do you lose this game?
Right. And so, and then Kike, oh, that was another thing. So we talked about, like, for sure Pollock's not going to start despite his numbers against Strasburg because he was struggling so bad. And then we talked about possibly not starting Lux. And we were saying maybe David Freese moves in. They went a different direction. They put, excuse me, whoever you chose here, it was either Beatty or Kike was the other guy in. But like Beatty started and played first base, I believe. Yeah, Kike was in left. So I think that's right. And
Freese was left in the pinch hit, right?
Yeah, later. Yeah. But Kike started, which was like, I think we texted something like that was a surprise because you figure like, they probably did it like for defense. Dave Roberts actually did say because Walker Buehler is more of a fly ball guy, so Kike is like their best defensive player of those of that group. Bellinger's your best defensive player, but like Kike's right there, I think. And I was thinking like Chris Taylor is an option if you're going to go that route, you know. And it's not like David Freese
at first.
That was sort
of what I had been thinking, yeah.
So they went defense and left, and I think he made like a weird like diving.
Yeah,
catch
he kind of had like a bad read on it up off the bat, but then yes. Made up for it and made a really good catch afterwards.
There were a couple of those in the series, like by both teams. Kike hits a home run, so like immediately justified because there was like so like I got a lot of lineup tweets that day. People were like, yeah, and so that was fun. 3-0, right? And then Buehler's kind of like not cruising, but like doing very well. Yep. He had a great game. And Dave Roberts said before the game, like, I'm going to ride him tonight. That was his actual quote. And he did. He threw like into the 100 and teens in pitches. He rode him until the seventh inning, and he left with two on and two out.
Yeah, you and I were talking a little bit. I thought if we had done this episode the day after the game, we might have ranked the Dave Roberts blunders, for the lack of a better term. And you said there were only two, but I think one of them that we didn't talk about is like, did he leave Buehler in too long to get Tumid on the bases?
Now, I think you mentioned four, and I will agree with you. I think mostly they're sub points of my two, which is, Fair. But you're right. Cause like, the first thing is like day off after game four, you have like essentially the full bullpen available.
And this is really interesting because Dave Roberts, the presser beforehand, there were two things that really kind of came across on this, you know, you're able to advance. All hands on deck, but they also kept kind of going back to this affinity for piggybacking Buehler and Kershaw.
Right. And usually what that means is, especially with a starter who's not used to relieving. I know Kershaw did it like that last Sunday of the regular season, and he's done it in the playoffs before, but it's not a familiar thing. So like,
especially this year when he's been so bad in the first inning.
Right. And usually what that means is like your piggybacker will come in to start an inning.
Fresh inning, half of a lineup.
And if there's like a situation in an inning like Buehler had in the seventh, that's what like Pedro Baez is for, you know, or look in this specific situation, because we'll get to this since they didn't use him later. They could have used Adam Kolarik to get Adam Eaton out at the end of the seventh to face one of the two like Nats lefties. I guess Matt Adams is the third, but you know, he was a pinch hitter only. They went with Kershaw, lefty on lefty. Fine. I get it. He got him, and like this was like, oh my god, I can't believe they're bringing him in this. They're like setting him up to fail. This is a weird situation. They have a full bullpen. They like, why are they doing this? And then he like carves up Eaton on three pitches. It's like, oh okay, Kershaw got his guy. That's cool. And then they got through it, and Kershaw goes out to start the eighth with Adam. This is where like sort of my first point. Although you mentioned that Kershaw bringing him in, that's also a point. But like, so you have Rendon and then Soto, righty lefty,
and that's kind of what you're getting. You're bringing on high leverage in the first instance because there's men on, and it's the middle of the lineup. Really, the only until the very very end, and your NLS MVP, Howie Kendrick, decided to hit real good. Rendon and Soto were really the only two batters I was afraid of, and to bring Kershaw in an unfamiliar-ish role. To face them, if you're going to bring him in to face Eaton, that's fine. But then to have them also face the two best hitters just was nerve wracking to me. I didn't want to say Ron. I don't like thinking I'm too much smarter. But boy, in hindsight, I can say that was correct to be doubtful.
Well, enough people were questioning it at the time. Like, absolutely. You're pressing your luck at that point. Like, and not the cool way, like with Peter Tomarkin. We just got up watching a clip of a bunch of game show stuff, so we're sorry if we're a little loopy right now. Yeah, so, at the, like, again, full complement of relievers available. I don't think Robert's been into it last game. I have to believe, given the way they use people, that, like, I don't think he mentioned this, but, like, he, there's a good chance that one or both of Pedro Baez and Julio Urias weren't available. And, like, that is a, like, a huge sort of dent in the bullpen, in the way they use the bullpen. So at this point, you're like, Kolarik is your lefty on lefty. To this point in the series, he faced Juan Soto thrice. Strikeout, ground out, strikeout. Didn't pitch in game four. So your option at this point, Kenta Maeda, you know, different than Kershaw because they always move him to the bullpen earlier in September, get him. And he has a specific skill where he, like, blows away right-handed hitters, especially when it's his stuff's playing up in relief. He's, like, good at it. It's not that unfamiliar to him. And so you can bring him in, even if it's just to face one batter to get Rendon. But like, just playing devil's advocate for a second, it's 3-1, right? So we learned in hindsight that Kershaw was going to face three batters. That was the plan. Two lefties with Rendon in between. In my head, I'm thinking, don't let him face the tying run, basically. Like, so if Rendon got on, like, he wouldn't face Soto. Like, that's what I was thinking in my head. But Rendon didn't get on. he crushed a pitch for a home run, as Kershaw's want to do these days. So it's 3-2. And you're like, oh, man, starting to worry. But, okay, lefty on lefty. Like, they're not making the move. Okay. So it's clearly he was going to – they said this after, but clear it's left. That's what they want, lefty on lefty. First pitch to Juan Soto, gone. Like, it unraveled so quickly. And, like, it was just, like, amazing. And, like, so – but, like, at this point, right, series not lost, but, like, still devastating.
Yeah.
Still five outs or no, still six outs to get because it's eighth inning with no outs. And then they do bring in Kenta Maeda, faces three right-handers and absolutely obliterates them, three strikeouts. And it's like, of course, right? But, you know, hindsight, all that stuff. He's facing different batters. I get it. But, like, okay, so at this point, you get through the eighth. They don't score in the eighth. It goes to the ninth. And then, again, full complement of relievers available. The issue was here, Maeda's spot came up in the eighth inning. So there was a lot of like, well, why didn't they just leave Maeda in? Well, they would have had to do a double switch.
There were a couple things, and we'll talk about another one here just a little bit, that I thought these remind me of the complaints I've seen over the last 2 years, which I either really disagree with and thought Roberts made a fine move or thought, you know, this is so close. This isn't the reason why the players lost this game.
Right. I think Farhan Zaidi used to call those like 52-48 moves or something, like, or it could go either way.
And on the Kershaw one, maybe you could just like you said, if Urias and Baez were out, but I just have such a hard time believing the Baez couldn't legitimately pitch one guy. Rendon, one guy with a day's rest in between. That seems like really sketchy to me that would be the case.
So and the reason this is a little sketchy, it didn't. So the way the postseason works, coverage wise, there's always like there's MLB like sets the sort of tone, and there's an interview room, and like every game pregame there's manager, and then the next day's starting pitcher. If there's an off day, it might be like a different odd player or something. Like Cody Bellinger spoke one of the games. Gavin Lux spoke another. But then post game, it's always like both managers talk at some point, and then it's usually the starting pitcher that night might come in, or like a winning player who did something, they might come in, and it's just kind of. But then that all the stuff in the interview room is like they have a transcription service that does that, but. Inside the locker room, that's where you get your like more like personalized stuff. They do more. They set up like this screen there, so there's probably like three or four like main interviews or something in front of the, because they all end up going on TV, so they have to have the stuff in the background that has the sponsors and stuff. So from a working solo standpoint, like I am, I'm not the LA Times with like, you know, six guys or whatever. six reporters, and like they can like split off and do different things. A lot of times I'll go in the clubhouse and then rely on the transcription later. And also it's a small room anyway, to get in there. So it's hard to get a question. I didn't talk to Dave Roberts post game. I was only looking at like what was asked, and it, like, that's pretty digging deep into the stuff. But one of the answers he gave was something like, you know, given like, he didn't say given who was available, but it was sort of the way he presented it, like the way I was reading it. So that's where I sort of figured, and like, again, it's not set in stone. I don't know this for a fact, but it seems the way they manage. So anyway, again, full complement of relievers outside of Baez and Urias. And they bring in Joe Kelly to start the night. Then you're so, like,
and here's,
you know what?
Here's where,
at this
like,
point,
yeah, like,
yeah.
He's, to me, oh, he had a
bottom
bad
of
game.
The order.
Yeah.
So, fine. Yeah,
he
that's
had,
what
he
you
had,
wanted.
Yes, he had a bad game in game four. Is that three? Game three. Yeah. But he had a fine game in game one, and since middle of May or whatever, has been one of the Dodgers' best relievers. I was very nervous about that. Again, thinking of narrative, like, oh God, this is of course how the Dodgers season is going to go blow up, is Joe Kelly's going to go give up a bunch of taters. But that was my heart. My head was like, no, this makes total sense. Bottom of the order is a really good time to kind of get through. And that first move, bringing him in the knife, proved fairly correct.
Yeah, he got through the three, like, easy peasy, right? Bottom of the order, 1, 2, 3. I will say this. So another concern with Kelly was that, so he, for the last, like, month of the season, maybe the last 3-4 weeks, general. It was basically general body soreness. They were being very vague about it. And they're like, well, it's not, like, a major thing, but they were never really specific. So in the exit meeting with Andrew Friedman, which was Monday, I did not go to it because I had a couple of appointments that I had to miss, or I had to miss that for those. But I was looking at some of the tape, and he mentioned Joe Kelly, and it said his injury started with the knee and the quad. There was some lower body stuff. Then it just got to arm soreness. There was nothing structural. It was nothing big. So like, it really was general soreness or whatever. And they were just sort of letting him rest.
Yeah,
basically,
and if it's nothing structural, that's a guy that you think probably can kind of will his body for a little bit. Not necessarily a guy, especially given the body of work in the season, that you want to send out for another inning against the top of the lineup.
And it
this
only
is
got
to me
that,
by far the worst move, the first, the most mind-boggling decision Dave Roberts made.
I want to say this for getting back to Kershaw for a second, just because we were sort of on him. So he was fine in game two. Like, he gave up three runs early, but he got through six. That's a winnable game, right?
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Not, you're not going to like castigate a guy. You're not going to like,
he's in the back half of his career.
There.
He was the third starter. This is that totally acceptable performance to me.
Right. And then, but then I think Andy McCullough had a really good thing in the Athletic today, essentially saying that the Dodgers need to move on from like the mythology about Clayton Kershaw. And like basically just treat him like a pitcher, you know, like, and not like, oh, this guy's our savior. We have to, because that's how they were sort of using him.
So, well, what's really interesting to me is I feel like they kind of did that for a lot of this year in the regular season.
Right,
and there's a lot, we'll have a question about this, where because the Dodgers just felt no real leverage basically at all in the regular season starting in the beginning of May, maybe that isn't as telling as we thought. But I had thought, especially when they made him the third starter, like, this was it. Like, you know what you got. You have the best pitcher of his generation on the back half of his career is going to give up a little bit more home runs because he doesn't have the velocity anymore. And if guys guess right, they're going to hit the ball out of the yard because the stuff just isn't there. But still a very good, very effective 2-3 starter.
So just going back to the post-game locker room, there was a lot of like shock and sadness in the Dodger locker room. Like, they're like stunned that their season ended right that night. They have obviously bigger plans, and so that's the harsh thing to deal with, right? And I remember 2017 was bad in terms of like post-game locker room. There was a lot of like, oh fuck, we lost, right?
Oh,
and and so
this deserves it.
Oh, man, I want to say, like, I can't remember, was Kershaw drinking wine? I don't want to make this like a meme or something. If he was, I'm trying to remember. He was just like so, like a he was just sad in 2017. Yeah. Like they lost, right? He's like, it was like, that was the year. I think we're going to look back at, like, especially if they don't win in the next couple of years, we're going to look like 2017 was the year.
Yep.
Right. And, like, they had it. And, so there was a lot of that, but I will say this, like, he seemed much like it, like this one got to him more, I think, or I think it's just, maybe it's all the weight of everything. So like his postseason ERA, it's 4.43, like full stop. That's it. There's no, I'm not like trying to parse different things. Like, of course, there's obviously going to go into that. I'm just saying.
And like, I think he has absolutely been mismanaged many of those years. No amount of mismanagement gets that to an elite playoff pitcher. So maybe they get you the sub four, but that's it.
Right. This is what Kershaw said after the game. Everything people say is true right now about the postseason, and I understand that. There's nothing I can do about it right now. It's a terrible feeling. And it like, the delivery of it was like, you know, again, that's what it felt like. So there was like a legitimate sadness in there. Rich Hill got like really choked up. Well, he's a free agent for one. And like, so that's one thing, but like, especially when he was asked about Kershaw, he had to stop because he was like almost crying. And like, you know, I'm trying to see. Oh, he said we wouldn't be here without him. And then that's the point where he stopped himself. And then he said, I have the ultimate respect for him, you know? And then like, it was like, man, that was like the tears were, there was a lot of hugs in the post game clubhouse.
We're going to,
go ahead.
No, I was gonna, you know what? Save your thought. We're going to take a break. We're already a little overdue. I'm going to cry in the aftermath here, and then we'll be back right after this break. Okay, we were talking about Rich Hill making me sad, making me cry.
Yep. Okay, so back to Joe Kelly. You mentioned you.
Now you just want to make me mad.
Yeah, this is the it's like a DJ of terrible moves. So the big thing was obviously bringing him back for the second inning, but the reason we got to that point was because Dodgers did not walk off in the ninth.
We've gone from sadness. We're out of order here. Sadness and then anger, and now I'm in unacceptance.
It's pretty, yeah.
Disbelief. Like denial. Denial in the Will Smith home run.
So remember the Cody Bellinger home run in Game 2 in 2017 that didn't go out?
I do. I was there.
And so, like, this was that, but, like, it's in a weird way, it's different because this season we've talked about it a lot. Like, ball was juiced. Like, the ball was different, and it flew more, like more home runs than ever, like by a lot. And then the Rob Arthur on Baseball Prospectus has done a lot of great work on this, just using pitch FX data, basically the air resistance is higher this postseason, and a lot of people have said, well, you know, it's better pitching, it's the weather, but like he looked at like the variance and like. It was something like 1 in a million chance that they didn't change the ball. So essentially MLB and like MLB's being really vague about this, like, oh, well, you know, it's the same from the same batch. I don't know what's going on. And then, but like MLB owns Rawlings. So like they're being really, that's the weird part. It doesn't have to be like this big conspiracy thing that they're messing around with the ball. But
they did it intentionally. Maybe they did, but I much more rather believe in a cost saving move. They changed something, and an inadvertent effect is all these home runs. That to me seems like by far the most likely scenario. Either way, just say, ball's a little different this year, and it might be different next year. And that's fine. Just say it.
Well, but like, what it's weird because no matter what they did, like the way they're acting about it makes that a story. Yes. And like, it's like, detracts from like the actual really good baseball going on. But the fact is, in the playoffs, there's been several like absolute shots that like would have clearly been out in the regular season and just haven't gone out. One of those was Will Smith in the ninth inning. So I was looking at this. Kike's on first with one out.
Who?
What?
Sorry.
It's great.
Second.
Yeah. And Smith hit a ball to right field. It was 100.3 miles an hour off the bat. Had a 640 expected batting average. And it fell right into the glove of Adam Eaton at the wall. Uh-huh. There was a shot where Will Smith like flipped his bat, and like I got a good screenshot of it. His eyes are like, I just ended this. This is great. Jeff Francoeur, as they're showing the replays, like, I thought Will Smith just ended it there. That's what he said. It did not go out. And then tweeted out like an overlay of 26 degree launch angle with that exit velocity. Every ball hit with those specifications overlaid at Dodger Stadium, and like all of them but like one are a home run. And it wasn't that one. It just like this was before this. Yeah. So like pretty much every ball hit like that in is a home run, and it wasn't. But like, so the funny part about this, right? Like, because it's happened a lot. And this is the harbinger of doom. Because look, the series, if you just stop right here, the series is over if that ball goes out. That's the fact of that. However, there was also a thing earlier in the game, Howie Kendrick in the fourth inning of game five. Mm-hmm. This was back when it was still 3-0. He almost hit a two-run shot to center, the one that Bellinger made a leaping catch at the wall. Actually, was it a three-run shot, I think? Yeah, and so this one was hit harder than Will Smith's and went longer and a slightly different launch angle. The expected batting average of this was 700. Smith's was 640. But that was caught by Cody Bellinger. So it's like best of both worlds, right? Or like you can't say one would have gone out and then the other wouldn't have in this scenario. So I get it. But at the same time, it is super frustrating. There's been a couple plays like it's always funny to see the pitcher like react like, oh, I just gave up a home run, or you know, they have that face, and then it's like, oh, it's flying at the wall, cool. Like but then there's been a couple plays like in the outfield where the outfielder's like, oh, and then they like have to react because the swing they saw all year long like went a certain distance, and then now they're like, oh wait, it's not going that anymore, like we have to adjust. So like it's very odd. So that Howie Kendrick home run, if you're a thinking person at that point. So at this point, I want to say Howie Kendrick was 1-for-12 in the playoffs on that flyout. That was not a home run. So uh-huh.
Has that changed?
Maybe. He's 9-for-26 since with 8 RBIs. For those game against Joe Kelly. We're in the 10th. Uh-huh. And then, okay, let's just back up for 1 second. When Joe Kelly comes in the ninth, right? You're at home. There's no save you can get anymore.
Yes, correct.
So there's no saving your closer for a save. So your best chance of winning is bringing your best reliever in to make sure the team is scoreless.
Yeah, either you don't trust him so much, so bring him in the ninth and let him face the bottom of the order, or you trust him and want to give him the high leverage spot, bring him in the 10th. Or who is awful when he goes for more than an inning, let's just bring him back out to face the top of the lineup.
And who's coming off general soreness and all this stuff and hadn't pitched 2 innings since August 24th. So, no Kenley. They did start warming up Adam Kolarik, which was like, oh, okay. So he might come in and face like Juan Soto again. And then immediately like Joe Kelly gets like two guys on at second and third. So they walk
Juan Soto.
They walk Juan Soto
because
intentionally instead of bringing Kolarik to face him. And then he said Dave Roberts said on this, he wanted to get a ground ball out of Kendrick. Guess who has a great ground ball rate? Better than Kelly actually does too. I will give him credit for this. But Adam Kolarik, that's his thing, right? Like, but I get it. You want a ground ball so you can get a double play, whatever. So this is how I sort of summed it up later. So we'll get to the Dodgers made like two. Oh no, I'm sorry. I won't put this on this for a second.
Sure.
They traded for one reliever at the trade deadline. We talked about this all. They're going to get multiple relievers. they're going to add to their bullpen, blah, blah, blah. They added one. That was Adam Kolarik, who had a very specific role, and that was facing Juan Soto in key situations. Soto, who hit the game-tying home run against Clayton Kershaw earlier, who was 0 for 3 against Kolarik in the series, at this point, so they just walked him instead of bringing in the Kolarik for his one singular duty. So they ignored the singular relief pickup they added midseason to let Joe Kelly face his eighth batter.
And to me, that's like, it's the combination. Yeah. If you really are dedicated to, we have numbers on Howie, whatever, like we think we can get him a ground ball, limit it to one or zero runs. We really think having all of the four sets available to us is more important than Juan Soto. Maybe they thought Juan Soto was starting to pick up on it. I don't care. I don't really care. You can maybe convince me on that. I wouldn't. I still think it's nuts. Bring Kolarik in. But then you don't let the guy that faces eighth batter, who not a guy that not one of your three lawn relievers. Where's Dustin May? Where are all these guys that we thought we were told to trust and build trust into to get all these key outs, as opposed to Clayton Kershaw in a second inning of Joe Kelly?
Like that's where you think, like another thing, where's Pedro Baez? Where's like a right-hander on right-hander right there? That's his spot, right? Like if it wasn't the eighth, it was that. So Joe Kelly then gives up a grand slam to Howie Kendrick, old friend Howie Kendrick. Howie Kendrick, after that grand slam, went on to win NLCS MVP this evening. So he sort of springboarded that. Game over, 7-3. Oh, but not before. So they bring in Jansen after the grand slam. Just the ultimate, like, oh, man. So it was clear they didn't like trust him in that game just in general. Andrew Friedman was non-committal in the sort of post wrap up. His quote, I'll just give it to you from Bill Plunkett. My sense sitting here is that Kenley will be our closer, and this is implying for next year, and then we'll see how things pan out. That was as far as he would go. You really don't know. So he has Kenley can actually opt out. There's no chance in hell he will.
Yeah.
He's got 2 years and $38 million left. I don't think he would get $38 million on a 3-year contract right now.
No, I don't.
Given how the relief market is and given how he's pitched. So there's no way. He's there. I'm pretty sure they expected that. It's fine. So that's an issue, but we'll talk about offseason stuff later. Just that's where it was in game five. They did not trust him enough to bring him in any of those points we talked about before. Yeah. So down 7-3, Patrick Corbin started the ninth, and so lefty on the mound. Jock Peterson due to lead off. Understandable. You pinch hit for Jock because that's what you do. You bring in a right-hander. Who do you bring in to start the AJ Pollock, who was 0 for 12 with 10 strikeouts, who finished the series 0 for 13 with 11 strikeouts. I will say this. I want to say possibly at least two, and I can't remember if it was a third different message, which was basically saying, this is the white fucking flag. Like, it was either text from brother, email from uncle. Like, you know, like they're down four. It's going to take like a miracle later. So they're figuring if Paula gets on, that's the miracle starter. Like, he had one of the worst series I've ever seen. 0-13 with 11 strikeouts. Yeah, and then so they just went down pretty quietly in the ninth, and they lost, and then it was over. I will point out, just because sort of, you know, like you said, teams lose games. Not that this was not incredibly disappointing, but for the series, Cody Bellinger, the two best, like, position players they've developed in the last, like, decade. Cody Bellinger, 4 for 19, 549 OPS, five-game series. Corey Seager, 3 for 20, 390 OPS. Bellinger in his career, 560 OPS in 36 playoff games. Seager, 605 in 31 playoff games. You know, at some point, you would think that, you know, your best players, we talked about this earlier, like in earlier years, like, you know, Kenley or Kershaw or someone pretty, like, important did not come through. in a big moment, and like it's like sort of the sort of pattern. Not saying that they're necessarily chokers, but you, at some point, like they have to hit for them to win. Yep. Like, so that's a problem when like two people you depend on, just are not there in the postseason. So that's an issue. Now, the fallout of this, like you mentioned, like just getting this off the table. Dave Roberts is coming back. Andrew Friedman confirmed it. I think Jorge Castillo reported it a couple days ago that like they're not firing him. But that it was even a question just shows you how terrible like Game 5 was. I wrote that it was the worst game he's ever managed. I know a lot of people are still mad.
To me, it's not close.
Yeah, there a lot of people are still mad about like Game 2 and pulling Rich Hill in 2017.
To me, those all made sense. Those were on plan. They had numbers to back it up. They had a plan that just didn't fit.
You have a dominant Kenley for two innings rather than current Kenley or like reduced Kenley or something. Yeah. I get it. But anyway, so we're not going to litigate 2 years ago. Yeah. But it was so bad. Like it was literally like, I think Ken Rosenthal wrote this. I think everyone was like intimating this was his Grady Little moment. Like all it took was like if one person, like if Mark Walter was like, what the hell? Like, right? Like all it takes is like one awkward, like what the hell was that? And then like he has 3 years left in his deal, but it's like you make the wrong person mad and then you're gonna go. But they're smart. They're not gonna like overreact to one game. I get it. But it was so bad that like that was a question. Although I think Friedman like sort of downplays, like I was kind of shocked that it was actually a question. So in his mind probably wasn't. I wonder about like ownership if they're thinking like maybe. Well, ownership was on Robert's side, like especially when he was hired. But like, and it they continue to back him. I think generally is good. Like it's not always X's and O's, but like sometimes it's like so egregious that sometimes you're like, God, like that was.
I will say, like, move on at that point. I think I've made it clear in the exasperation in my voice on this episode. I was not a fan at all of how Game 5 was managed. And this is coming from one of the biggest defenders of Roberts, I think I have been over the last, since his tenure started. I definitely thought, despite being a defender, that he did not manage a good game. But at a certain point, if your team is a manager's mistake away from losing a ball game, that's on the team and that's on the players. And I would love to just watch a Dodger team go 3 playoff series where the manager can't lose it.
Yeah. There was a point where like, even in game 4 of the NLCS tonight, the Nationals pulled the Cardinals on the Cardinals. They went up 7-0 in the first inning in game 4. And then that became like 7-4, like in the middle innings, and like Patrick Corbin was kind of struggling, and there was like still a runner on base, and like Dave Martinez like kept him in, and it was like, man, he's really pushing it here, and it's like, yeah, it worked out. Sometimes it just works out, like whatever. Dave Martinez, mind you, he put the tying run on base.
He walked Muncy to get to
2.
Will Smith, right?
Yeah. Like, no, to get to Seager. Or was it...
I think it was Will Smith.
I don't remember. Yeah. And that didn't...
And then Seager walked. Will Smith walked, and then Seager got to bat.
That's right. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's sometimes it works out. Sometimes
And, you know, Kershaw gave one batter where he kind of bailed Roberts out. I'd like just a few series of those. Win the one.
Right. At that point, like, you won with a 17 because the dealer like 6 card busted or something. You're up. Like, just walk away at that point. Like, just leave the table. But so I'll say this about Roberts. He gets a raw deal because if he does well, he's a puppet for the front office, right? That's the criticism. And like, he's not really managing the games, like blah, blah, blah. I don't know what people actually think goes on like in the game. Like they're calling down and making moves. There's a definite like relationship of like they talk about like strategy and planning and stuff, but like in-game stuff, Roberts is making the decisions. Now, he's the front office like providing him with a lot of data saying, hey, this would be cool if like you did it this way. But like unless he's like continues to like make like egregious mistakes, they're not gonna they're not going to like scold him or like say, hey, they just present him with the data and then he's making the decision. So like, I think it's kind of unfair to him that he's like portrayed as this puppet when I don't think that's the case at all. But yeah, so the other thing, again, we're talking about off-season stuff later, but so Andrew Friedman, his 5-year deal is up after this year. He said he's about to sign a new deal, so that was kind of expected. There was some rumblings out of Boston because they fired Dave Dombrowski that, oh, maybe they're going to go after Friedman, but like doesn't sound like that's going to be the case. So yeah, so that's the case there. The other sort of news that came out, David Freese was first. He retired. Mm-hmm. This was sort of expected. He's talked about it like different times this year, I think. 36, did really, really well in his time, pretty limited role, and he was injured a little bit, but like when he played, he was great. Very good Dodger experience for him, I think. But yeah, retired after 11 years. The other one was Rick Honeycutt, pitching coach for 14 years. The last couple years, they've talked about this, like eventually he's going to move into like some sort of front office, like pitching specialist guru type person. It's a little bit of a lesser role where he doesn't have to travel as much. He had a lot of like injuries this year that he sort of dealt with, and so I think that was part of it. But his 14 years on the job tied Ron Paranowski for the most by a Dodger pitching coach, and I'm pretty sure he has the most games because Paranowski's first year was 81 and his last year was 94, both strike years. So take that, Ron Paranowski. But yeah, so, and then it's not official yet, but Mark Pryor, the bullpen coach, was expected to step in. He did a lot of just general work in the planning and stuff this year. So I think it's going to be seamless. We'll see. But Honeycutt had a very, very good run. Dodgers have always had like good pitching, like just in their history, but like, especially under Honeycutt, look, he was a pitching coach during like Clayton Kershaw era. So that's part of it. But also like they had a lot of like, you know, other pitchers besides Kershaw, and he did a pretty good job of like helping develop that. So that's sort of his thing. So yeah, good for Honeycutt. He had a good run, as we like to say.
Well, I'm happy to move on from Game 5. We have a few notes. You might mention Game 5 in it a couple of times. I'm not looking forward to it. And then we've got 5 questions from Craig after this. So I have these questions from Craig, but I know you have sort of a potpourri of notes you wanted to talk about, just kind of in the National League playoffs and maybe some Game 5 notes, some national notes before we moved on.
Yeah, so I just laugh because, like, you know, everyone talks about momentum in baseball and, oh, you got to be hot going into the playoffs and all this stuff. The Dodgers had their best month of the season in September, and then they lost.
Like, it's really funny how the Dodgers, to show, oh, you need this to succeed, the Dodgers have shown they can take anything and fail in the playoffs.
Right, yeah.
It could be awful September in 2017, no stakes in 2019, or really high intensity, every game matters in 2018, and they can lose with them all. Don't worry about it.
And so, but to extend that a little bit to the Nats were down 3-0 in their wild card game and down in the 8th inning of the wild card game, 1. They were down 2-1 to the Dodgers.
What?
1 game 4. They were down 3-1 with 6 outs to go in game 5 on the road. They won that game and then they swept the Cardinals. So, like, I always laugh at this because, like, they're going to. Look, their pitching has been ridiculous, the Nationals. Starting pitching, including Anibal Sanchez and then also Patrick Corbin, their starting pitching has like a 2.14 ERA in 10 games. So, like, it's Strasburg and Scherzer have been great, but also Patrick Corbin and Anibal Sanchez have been really good. Corbin struck out like 12 tonight. They have like – it's something like 35 strikeouts the last 3 nights from their starting pitchers. So, pretty crazy. But like I always laugh at the biggest like momentum shift I ever saw, the 96 Braves. So they're the defending world champions. They're down 3-1 in the NLCS to the Cardinals. They win the last 3 games, including the game 7, win 15-0. They go into Yankee Stadium. This was when I believe Andrew Jones was 19 or 20 and he hit 2 home runs. They blow out the Yankees in one of the 2 games. They win both games. So the Braves have won 5 straight games at this point. They outscored their opponents 45-2. They're going back home to Atlanta up 2-0, looking to win a second straight World Series. and they lose four straight. So, like, it could change on a dime. Like, you just never know. So, like, that's baseball, right? Like, the Dodgers were buzzsawing people in 2017. They swept the Diamondbacks. They went up 3-0 against the Cubs. They won that in five. They won game one against Houston, and they had a lead in game two, almost won. And so, yeah, and then they didn't win. So, like, that's just how it goes sometimes, and the Dodgers will have to wait another year.
All right, you ready for this?
Yay.
It's time for...
Questions from Craig.
Speaking of the Nationals, now that they have clinched the National League pennant, rank the following teams from best chance to worst chance to make their respective finals. The Mariners, the Lions, the Clippers, and the Maple Leafs.
Okay, so...
who is most likely?
The Clippers, which is a weird thing to say in history.
Yeah.
But, like, this year, specifically, in the NBA, wide open. The Warriors lost Kevin Durant. Klay Thompson's hurt. They're going to struggle a little bit. At least by the playoffs, they might be, you know, in full strength. Houston still has some problems. They're also going to figure out how to work the Russell Westbrook, Russ Harden thing. The Lakers have Anthony Davis and LeBron together, but, like, something that will happen. Like, I don't trust them yet. But, like, there's a lot to do. The Bucks are still really good. Like, Celtics are looking really good. The Nets are, like, getting there. They have Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving. I don't know if they're, like, championship ready yet. But, like, anyway, wide open league. But the Clippers, Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, they have an excellent defensive team. I think, like, they're up there with, like, they have to be, like, considered one of the favorites. And I think just that alone puts them at number one for me. Number two is the Maple Leafs, who I know nothing about. But I know they're not the Lions and Mariners. So, and, like, weird things happen in baseball. And I think it might not. It probably won't be under Jerry DePoto. It'll be under whoever the next general manager is. But I have to think the Mariners will get to the World Series before the Lions get to the Super Bowl. So I'm going with the Mariners and the Lions. Trivia: with the Nationals winning tonight, the Nationals/Expos are now, they have a one in the pennant collection. So the Mariners are the only team in baseball history to never make the World Series. The only franchise to never make the World Series.
Ouch. My order, I think I'd go Clipper, Maple Leafs, Lions, Mariners.
And I could see that.
I just trust sort of weird parity in NFL a little more, even though baseball has shown itself to be a fairly high parity league.
And by the, we're both quibbling over the fact that you think the Lions are going to get to the Super Bowl in 2088 and the Mariners in 2093?
Correct. That's...
I'm the other 2 years. Yeah.
Do either of you think that there is anything to the idea of the Dodgers never having any real competition aside from themselves for the last 2-3 months of 2019 contributed to their postseason downfall?
I don't think so. Yeah. Like,
they had plenty of adversity last season, and the offense went the way of the dodo just as quickly. I mean, they lasted a little bit longer, but the offense was awful against the Brewers, and just the Brewers kind of matched pace as well.
Yeah, if you look back at that series, like, they were very close to going down 0-2, and they had that home run from Justin Turner, like, late in the, I think, in the eighth inning, and, like, that would have been brutal. But, like, it's hard to – I think it's – basketball is one of those where it is more of a flip the switch sport. I think where you're either playing up or down to your competition because there's a flow to the game. But I think baseball, it's like, it's so, like, individual based. I mean, obviously it's a team game, but, like, it's the batter versus the pitcher. And I think, like, that is still going on, and, like, they're still, like, going out and doing stuff, and I don't think the opponent necessarily matters. Like, obviously you get up for certain games, but, like, I don't think there's much to that. Cause, like you said, we've seen it, like, both ways. on that. And really, it really, like, just...
Maybe, the only thing you could, I think you could maybe talk about is maybe there's something to... And I have no evidence for this. This is just something I see. I've seen some people spitball it, and I don't dismiss it outright, is perhaps the Dodgers, more uniquely than other teams' approach to hitting, struggles against great pitching. This came up a little bit in Boston because they weren't, they weren't playing the contact as often, high strikeout rates, and they fixed a lot of that this season. But perhaps there's just still something to that sort of Blanche angle era, that for whatever reason, when you face elite pitching, which the Nationals clearly have, especially lately, to that. But even then, I think that's a stretch.
Yeah, and another thing that was good this year, like you mentioned, they decreased their strikeout rate. They're still like the best at, or one of the best at, like not chasing pitches. But this year, as opposed to like the last couple years, they were excellent. The Dodgers were at hitting high velocity fastballs. I think like 95 mile an hour plus. Like they were excellent at that. And so like, not that every like good pitcher throws that hard, but like that's a pretty good barometer.
This is
of
a
like
really good
that.
Example of where I always feel at such a disadvantage compared to people who work at a front office. Not to say that, oh, they're so much smarter than me, how could I ever do that? I think we've heard enough stories after the fact that says like, sometimes they're just winging it. But I have wondered, especially after this Cardinals series, if the National Scouting Department, especially when coming up with pitching plans, it helps to have the pitchers they have, but just nailed it in this postseason.
Yeah, so like
when Animal Sanchez is pitching as good as he is, I wonder how good that report is.
Well, he carved up the Cardinals too.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
He has like his changeup is like slow, slower, and slowest, and like they literally call it a butterfly. And like Steven Strasburg was not, he was, well, he had like a lot of stuff on in both starts. Really, he struggled in Game 5 early, but then he picked it up and got through 6. But like it wasn't his fastball necessarily. Maybe the command was great, but like he wasn't blowing them away. It was he was getting in Game 2, he was getting them to chase on every like curveball and changeup, and then they were like waiting that out a little in Game 5, which let them get to him early, and they just didn't score after the second inning. So that's a problem. But like they struck out like a ton in this series against the Nationals. So like it was like everything they had like made strides on went out the window. The Dodgers, I believe, set a – oh, I had the series page up. 1 second. Yeah, they set – woo-hoo, record. They set a record with 64 strikeouts in 5 games.
Great.
So just as a comparison, the Nationals struck out 42 times in the series. So,
can't wait to stop talking about baseball. I'm getting depressed all over again. Here's a name that doesn't depress me. Rich Hill is certainly one of the most sincere and entertaining Dodger players to be on the Dodgers in many years. But did management place too much on the idea of using him instead of preparing another pitcher for that 4-starter role come the postseason?
Well, I guess like
I don't think so. I feel like they had come to the conclusion that there was no great option.
Yeah,
fairly, and maybe they came to that too quickly. I think maybe you could make that point.
Right, and here's one of those things where it gets like it's like a combination of things where it all is a one big ball of frustration. Because you look at it now, right? Dustin May ended up being like one of their better relievers in September, also not using Game 5, but like he's a starter, right? So like. And if it's not him, it's Gonsolin as sort of your Rich Hill backup. If Rich Hill wasn't like, didn't prove himself to sort of be healthy, but I see they wanted him in relief. And again, they didn't really use him in relief either. Yeah, so like, but he's another option. But then look at all these years. So like Julio Urias coming off of like surgery. So this is his first year back. He's still, I am looking, I forgot what he did in two. Okay. So 2016 in the majors and minors combined, he actually did get to 122 innings, plus what he did in the playoffs. So like, but this year, 79 2/3 innings plus. I hate to say you have to go to two different pages for the postseason. So counting the postseason, he pitched 83 innings. 84 innings, basically. No, 83 innings. 83 innings, yeah. And so now we kept hearing, like, well, next year Governor's going to be off, right? Like, we're going to he's going to finally have a ramp to be a starter. And then you know at some point next year they're going to be like, well, he did only throw 83 innings last year. So, like, he has this, like, perpetual limit. So, like, eventually, maybe this is another Strasburg situation where he just started earlier. And, like, so, like, again, this was his age 22 season. So by age, like, 27, he's going to qualify for his first ERA title. And, like, it's going to be with a different team because the Dodgers will be like, well, we couldn't really push him that far this year.
Cynical episode I think we've ever done. Rightfully so, yeah. After that game five.
And so. And that's another thing. Like Maeda, like, oh, yeah, one of the things that came out, Andrew Heber's like, well, we clearly see Maeda as a starter next year. Well, yeah, you say that every year. And then late August or September, he's going to be in relief again. So, like, that's another option. Like, I will say the bullpen, like, game sucks. Like, starting pitchers have been really good this postseason. Part of that, again, is the ball. But part of that is because starting pitchers are good in general. Like, they're good to have. Players who last long, I'm not trying to, like, belittle, like, the opener. I'm talking about an actual, like, bullpen game where your starter's not going to – your bulk guy is not going to go more than, like, three innings or something. And, like, it wasn't realistic. They said Rich Hill would try to go four. I don't think it was realistic to expect that. So the problem with the bullpen game is that the more people you use to get all those outs, the more the likelihood of someone having a bad game. And we saw that in game four, and they had the one bad inning where Urias was pitching on back-to-back and wasn't very good. And then it just wasn't good. So, like, I would rather have a starter. And they certainly have a multitude of pitchers who could start, but yeah, I wonder if that's over to get through 162 games. Maybe it's optimal to split all those innings up like that. But I have to think next year is the year where, you know, some of these guys get a run and, like, let them start, man.
Yeah, and I think so too, and I think we'll see that. I definitely felt like, from, again, you always have to kind of predict, Jason, on how they're using your players, that they were trying to find someone that, when they looked at it, they would trust for that, getting them four or five innings in that game four, and they just didn't see a better option. Maybe Dustin May should have been that guy, but maybe they just had decided by the time he looked as good as he did, they had shortened his arm too much. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certain that's part of it. But then another thing, like, again, like, a bullpen, like, game is cool when you have, like, you know, eight or nine relievers at the ready, which they had sometimes this year, and if all those are available, like, then you
and
get
then if you
after
lose
game
them in
four,
game four, they shouldn't hit you. They shouldn't feel burnt in game five.
Yes, exactly. Especially with the off day in between. So, like, it's just.
I do not think it's the new opener. I do not think it's a strategic decision. Could they have done this year? Maybe, maybe not. I'm not sure. But we'll talk about who might fill that role in our off-season preview episode whenever we record next.
Yeah, it'll be a cold day in hell before we see another bullpen game in the playoffs.
I've asked this before, yes. But hey Siri, how's it going?
I don't know. I didn't say Siri. How did that trigger that?
I've asked this before, but thought maybe it's time for an update. Besides, of course, this, the True Blue LA podcast, what other podcasts will each of you spend time catching up with for the next 3 to 4 months? I'm just imagining you and me actually listening to a year's worth of our own podcast in the off season. Remember that Cody Bellinger pace update? That was a great one.
We send each other notes like, hey, nice prediction, idiot. You know, that's basically all of it. Like, you're just making fun of each other for being completely wrong on every prediction. So I have fallen way behind. Oh, I actually have. How did this get made? I have, like, I think, like, 8 or 9 episodes, which is shameful. So that'll be a fun. That'll be a fun catch up. I would say there's a lot of Judge John Hodgman that I haven't listened to. I'm actually just scrolling through. Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, pretty good. I like that a little bit. I don't know if I could power through like 5 of those in a row.
Yeah.
But I have a number of those saved. I have been lapsing on effectively wild, but a lot of those are timely. So
that's definitely what I found, because I two podcasts I really enjoy are basketball podcasts, The Low Post from Zach Lowe, and Dunked On from I forget his first name. Nate. I was going to say Nathan, but it's not Nathan. Nate Duncan. But again, and which are both really, really good. The Dunked On podcast is extremely heady, and it's like week daily, and they're always like an hour and a half long. And I just like, if it's 2 days old, it's just so out of rigor. So basically when new basketball news happen, I'll turn on one of those. The Low Post it lasts a little bit longer, I find sometimes, so maybe I'll do that. But I just don't drive that much, and that's really the only time I love listening to podcasts. My wife and I make a road trip twice a year that's about 6 hours each way, and Pod Quiz, the weekly trivia quiz podcast, and Ask Me Another NPR show. Well, I will usually bank those for that drive because they're really good for longer road trips. I guess the only other one I want to shout out is Arena Deckless for any Magic the Gathering player.
All right.
There you go.
My trivia show is Go Fact Yourself, which I believe John Wiseman was a guest on as an expert. I think I have a bunch of We Got This still on the hopper. The podcast with Joe Posnanski and Michael Schur, I have a bunch of those still to listen to. There's a lot of I have lapsed on Infinite Inning. I do have a lot to catch up on. There's a couple Comedy Bang Bangs I haven't listened to. Generally, I will, the ones I for sure will listen to every week, almost even if I'm busy, are like Comedy Bang Bang, The Doughboys, and Never Not Funny. Are like pretty reliable, and that I'll listen to it. But the rest of them are like I'm just behind on. So I will say this: I am traveling soon. I am going to the World Series. It'll be the third year in a row for me. This year I actually get to travel. It was originally sort of planned that I was going to go to the first two games, no matter where it was. So I actually booked travel to Houston and to New York. But then the ALCS is the second series, and so they end either Saturday or Sunday. And I had, like, sort of planned my travel around maybe going on Sunday. And, like, I was realizing, like, man, that might not happen. Like, I might have to wait, and then I have to rebook it. But then, like, once the Nationals were up, like, 3-0, and we have our box, like, SB Nation has an office in Washington, D.C., I'm like, why don't I just go to the middle three games and I can go to the office like 1 or 2 days I'm there and actually go to the office and meet some of the people I work with, which is cool. So like then they're like, yeah, just do that. And so that's what I'm doing. So I have two long plane rides and including a layover in Austin both ways. So I will be listening. I'll be catching up on quite a few of these podcasts.
And finally, last question of the episode. I'm going to name
food items.
Yeah. I want you to tell me if you are more likely to make this at home or eat it at a restaurant. You ready?
Three
of them. Chicken.
I will say restaurant only because of fried chicken. And like I eat chicken breast or chicken thigh like pretty regularly at home, so that might be a close one.
Chicken is by far my most eaten protein, so it's definitely at home. Buffalo wings are the one exception where
that's true.
Restaurant item.
Yeah, I guess it is probably home, but I think that's the one I enjoy the most in terms of something like succulent or like juicy chicken. Very good. So
salmon.
Oh, that's for sure home.
Yep, same.
I that's one of those. That's like an impulse buy for me. If I'm in the grocery store, I'll be like, "Oh yeah, that sounds good," and then I'll make it like that day when I get home or something. Like I like salmon quite a bit.
Last one, spaghetti.
So I almost never order that out. There's been a couple times where I've gone to the old spaghetti factory just out of sort of nostalgia. And I sort of enjoy that from an old school, like sort of like I very occasionally might go to Sizzler, because because that used to be a birthday thing for me growing up. And so, but other than that, like I only eat spaghetti if I make it at home.
I'm sort of the pasta in general with like mac and cheese as a very special treat exception. Never make it at home anymore, just because like if I'm eating it at home, I'm usually taking it as an opportunity to eat a little healthier.
Yep.
So if I'm using red sauce, it's usually just on chicken or, you know, with greens or something like that. So I don't know the last time I ordered it eating out, but I'm gonna lump that kind of broadly with pasta and say
restaurant. I could see that. So the one thing I mean, because it's a lot of carbs, obviously, so I don't really make it a ton. But it's a staple food. It's literally like I think I have probably like 4 bags of spaghetti in my cupboard right now that, you know, it'll take a while to get through. But the one thing I used to do a lot, and I still sort of do, I don't go full like heavy sauce. And I don't make like fresh sauce really, because I'm just eating for myself usually, and so I will use like something in a jar or in a can. But a lot of times I will just do like a can of like diced tomatoes and then put a bunch of seasoning and like add mushrooms or something to that, or, you know, do it something like that, and then do that with chicken. So then it's a little bit lighter. Obviously, it's still heavy on the carbs, but like that was sort of my justification for like eating more spaghetti back in the day, although I really haven't eaten that a ton lately.
And that's it.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
So, as is a tradition with you and me after the Dodgers season is done, it's been the end of the baseball season, last 2 seasons. You and I are going to take a little bit of a break, at least 1 week, maybe 2.
Yep.
I think it'll probably only be 1.
Traveling in between, yeah.
Yeah.
I think...
It'll depend maybe a little bit on how the World Series goes and how it's looking, probably.
Right. It would be like whether the Nationals win in 4 or 5 games against the Yankees or Astros. So like, I think that's true. We're both going to be traveling in between. And then, pretty much after the World Series, we'll have sort of a better like view of sort of what like the Dodgers are going to do this offseason.
A lot of that offseason stuff doesn't really start till the day of or the day after the World Series has ended. So,
right. Which the last 2 years has been, right after the Dodgers lose. But now it's nope. There is still a possibility, because obviously the Yankees or Astros will be favored. They'll have home field advantage over the Nationals. The Astros are up 2-1 as of record. But if the Nationals were to somehow win, I think Dustin Nosler pointed this out on Twitter, that the Dodgers will have lost to the world champion for the 4th straight year in the playoffs. So, yay! Hooray to them. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yep.
Hang your bandage.